for joining us to learn more about the new sunscreen guidelines. With us today is Dr. Roman Bronfenbrenner, a dermatology resident at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Dr. Bronfenbrenner, how do the new sunscreen guidelines affect the product's labeling, and what information should dermatologists give their patients?
Well, hello, and thank you for having me here. I wanted to thank Cutis, first of all, for giving me the opportunity to speak about this, and also my Department of Dermatology here at Stony Brook for giving me the opportunity to work on these projects. The FDA sunscreen guideline passed in December of 2012 makes several changes to the labeling and marketing of sunscreen, which will benefit consumers and will actually put dermatologists and consumers on the same page in terms of recommendations for appropriate sunscreen use. The first change that happened with the FDA guidelines is regarding the claims of broad-spectrum efficacy. For a sunscreen to be defined as broad-spectrum currently, it needs to have adequate ultraviolet B and ultraviolet A coverage. Previously, only the sun protection factor, SPF, was used to gauge the effectiveness of a sunscreen. And the main pitfall with just using that one number is that it only reflects the UVB coverage of a sunscreen. And so you can have a very high SPF and still have UVA rays transmitting through that sunscreen and causing adverse effects such as skin aging and carcinogenesis. And so the broad spectrum claim can now only be on sunscreens that have adequate UVB and UVA coverage. Now, in the United States, UVA is measured through an in vitro test, which is known as the critical wavelength test. And basically, for a sunscreen to be labeled as broad spectrum, it needs to have 90% of the sunscreen's absorbance needs to be by 370 nanometers, which is in the long wave UVA spectrum, for it to get labeled with broad spectrum. And so, in other words, if you see that label of broad spectrum, you know that you have both UVB and UVA protection. The next change was in regards to usage claims. And so basically, if you use a sunscreen now and you read the back, the sunscreen is broad spectrum and has an SPF of 15 or higher, you will see that the sunscreen manufacturer can claim that, A, it reduces the risk of sun damage and skin cancer and sunburns. However, it'll also reduce the risk of sun-induced skin aging, which is a nice perk for people that maybe are looking for another reason to put on sunscreen every day. You could say the decrease in wrinkles is definitely a perk for people. The next change is in regard to resiliency claims. Prior to these guidelines passing in 2012, there were wide discrepancies between claims that sunscreen manufacturers made and actual real-world use. So in the past, they used to be able to claim things such as all-day protection. They used to be able to claim waterproof, sweatproof, blizzardproof, tornadoproof, really whatever they wanted to put on a sunscreen label, they were able to put without any science to back up their claims. And so the new resiliency claims basically only have three gradations. There's no longer something waterproof. There's now water-resistant, and it's either a sunscreen is not water-resistant, in which case it's not listed, or is water-resistant for 40 minutes or 80 minutes at most of outdoor use. And so these sunscreens, really right on the front of the packaging, will remind patients that even though this may be a sport sunscreen, if it's an 80-minute product, it's something that needs to get reapplied every 80 minutes, and it's not something that will protect them for the duration of their water activities if they spend an entire day at the beach. All sunscreens now are required to label that they are to be reapplied every 2 hours. We know that sunscreen efficacy really degrades after 2 hours, and also sunscreens that are not labeled as water resistant are required to recommend a water resistant sunscreen for patients that are in wet type activities. Finally, these new resiliency claims still recommend that sunscreen should be reapplied after towel drying, and particularly more frequently if the patients are swimming or sweating. The next change is that the FDA now really views sunscreen and wants to transmit to the consumer the information that sunscreen is just one component of safe sun practices. So it's not enough to just put your sunscreen on in the morning and you're good for the day. You should really be seeking shade. The packaging will say seeking shade between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. I expand on that a little bit with my patients, and I say, if you look down and your shadow is shorter than you are, the sun is probably too strong and you should be avoiding it or at least seeking shade. The new sunscreen guidelines also require that the back of the sunscreen recommend wearing both appropriate sun protective clothing and eyewear to decrease the risk of ultraviolet light-induced sun damage as well as ocular damage. These FDA guidelines are not all-inclusive. There's still a couple of controversies remaining. One of them is the vehicles for the sunscreen. Certain products that we might see either on the store shelves or at the American Academy of Dermatology meetings as, you know, products that we sell out of the dermatologist's office, and they come in many different vehicles. Some of them come in plagettes and towelettes. Some of them come as powders, shampoos, body washes. None of those products are included in the FDA guidelines, and even though they may have claims on the front of them, they will never have an FDA code on the back, at least with this current revision. And the reason behind that is it's very difficult to substantiate these claims and to test these products in vitro, and it's difficult to really see how a shampoo or a body wash, when people have different bathing habits, how it would offer the SPF protection that it claims on its label. And so those are not yet incorporated into the FDA guidelines. Another controversial vehicle is spray sunscreens, and even though spray sunscreens can still be labeled with the FDA code now, there is still some controversy regarding the actual efficacy, not just the in vitro efficacy, because spray sunscreens can disperse if they're put on, you know, in a windy day, and people can have a different level of SPF protection depending on whether or not they rub it in, how far away from their body they hold the spray, and all these different elements make it difficult to go from an SPF or a critical wavelength to actual real-life applications. And so that is still an area that is yet to be addressed. Also, aerosolized foam has not been addressed, and the potential for inhalation of any of these sunscreens, particularly with zinc or titanium products, is still something that's an issue. At this point in time, I have patients that really just prefer a spray sunscreen, will not use a sunscreen if it's not a spray sunscreen, in which case, you know, you're not left with a lot that you can recommend them. So I'm stuck recommending a spray sunscreen, but I always tell them to avoid the face and to only use it in well-ventilated areas. The final point of contention is the maximum SPF rating that the FDA will allow. There's some debate about incorporating the European guidelines, which are putting a maximum SPF of 50-plus on all sunscreens. And there's proponents and opponents of legislation of this in the United States. The proponents' main point is that using a higher SPF rating really only exposes the skin to higher concentrations of these potentially irritating or allergenic chemicals without really getting a net increase in UVB or UVA protection. They believe that a lot of times these high numbers may give people a sense of immunity from the sun, that if they put on a very high SPF, they don't need to reapply the sunscreen, which is absolutely incorrect. No matter what the sunscreen is, after 2 hours, the efficacy starts to degrade. Opponents of this legislation believe that higher SPF sunscreens may have some benefit for consumers. I tend to fall in line with the opponents against this legislation, and the reason is, in vitro, sunscreens are tested with a relatively thick layer. They put 2 milligrams per centimeter squared of sunscreen before they run testing for UVB or UVA, and people don't use that in the real world. Otherwise, you'd see a lot of people walking around with streaks and streaks of sunscreen on their face and on their clothing. In reality, people use probably half or a quarter of that. And so, in fairness, sunscreen that says SPF 30, by the time you factor in real-world application, a patient might only be getting SPF 7.5 or SPF 10 or 15. So higher SPF numbers in vitro might actually lead to higher numbers in vivo. And this is actually particularly important for patients, for example, with photosensitive dermatoses who are at risk of UVB or UVA-induced exacerbation of their disease. And if they're not applying enough of the sunscreen or the number is not high enough, they could still get an exacerbation even though they feel they are protected. As a final recommendation, with these current FDA guidelines having been released and now pretty much on every sunscreen on the shelf, it's good to have general recommendations for patients. I have a hard time recommending one particular product, and it's because everybody is very variable in their preference. Some people prefer something that's a cream, some people prefer a lotion, and we see this not just with sunscreens, we see this with moisturizers, we see this with topical steroids, and pretty much every other topical vehicle that we put on patients, everybody has their own preference. And so I give patients general guidelines of what to look for, and I tell them to look for a broad spectrum product that tells us that it will have UVB and UVA protection, and I tell them to look for an SPF of 30 or higher. I always stress with patients that they need to remember to reapply the sunscreen at least every 2 hours. And I also tell them that it should just be part of their daily routine, maybe to find a moisturizer that has sunscreen built into it, so that way when they go out for the day, they have something already on board, and if they decide to stay out or it turns into a spontaneous outdoor day, they can always reapply sunscreen and they'll be protected in advance. So I thank you for your time and attention, and thank you again to CUTIS for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you, Dr. Bronfenbrenner, for your overview of the new sunscreen guidelines that will help make patients more educated. For more information, access Dr. Bronfenbrenner's Resident Corner columns here on CUTIS.com.